Waiting for the world to change. Welcome to another Mind Expansion episode of Cosmic Horizons, streaming out live to the world and beyond from our studios in Toronto. Stay with us, because some people call him the media ecologist, some a visionary into the future, others just call him Bob Dobbs. He's here with us on the phone, so stay tuned. We'll be right back with my guest, Mr. Bob Dobbs. Since 1992, Paranoia, the Conspiracy and Paranormal Reader has enlightened readers with alternative views and marginalized theories of the inner workings behind socio-political events. Think of Paranoia Magazine as a time capsule. Open it and wonder who left it there. Paranoia Magazine on newsstands now, or subscribe at our website at www.paranoiamagazine.com. PreferredNetwork.com. We carry only the best sellers from David Icke, Ted Gunderson, Eustache Mullins, and Tex Mars, including rare and hard-to-find out-of-print books. We only deliver the best of the best to acquire the most comprehensive conspiracy collection of books and videos available anywhere. Come visit us at our website at PreferredNetwork.com today. Welcome back to Cosmic Horizons. With me on the phone is Mr. Bob Dobbs, who has agreed for this special interview about his views and perception of the media today and where we might be headed. So welcome to Cosmic Horizons, Bob.
Hey, welcome, James. Glad to be here.
Well, just Bob, we were just talking off the mic. It's a damn snowstorm here in Toronto right now. I just can't believe this this weather going into April. So it's mild where you are right now, so that's always a good thing.
Yeah, well, McLuhan said that Canada represents a cold front against the American commercialism.
Well, Bob, before we get started, can you tell the listeners about there, who's Bob Dobbs? Because some people out there sometimes have you confused with J.R. Bob Dobbs and affiliation with the Church of the Subgenius. Now, there's no connection between the both of you, is there?
No, I was born in Paris in 1922. You've heard of the Da Vinci Code and the Priory of Sion. Well, that story isn't totally accurate, but my father was a butler for the actual Priory of Sion, going back for 300 years, and our family has been a butler function for 300 years. Charles Dickens mentions my great-grandfather in a story he wrote in 1853 called The Toady Tree. And so we've been doing that in Europe for a long time, and I grew up in that situation. But after World War II, the trust funds, or the fondi, known as the Prior Sion, were weakened, and so they needed new input in terms of employees that could keep confidentiality, so I was brought in through my father, so I remained an employee of what I call the Solar Government, but actually it's the Secret Council of Ten, all through the 56, 70s, and 80s until I became chairman of the Secret Council of Ten. That's a long story how that happened. Mm-hmm. And part of it was caused by me being on CKLN in Toronto from 87 to 89, 90, and then finished up in 91. But I actually used the show in February 88 to become chairman of Secret Council 10. Then Nelson Thal, now known as Lenny Bloom, yeah, put out an album in 92 made by Dave Neufeld, now producer for Broken Social Scene. And that album went out on the market, and a lot of people thought it was about the J.R. Bob Dobbs, the Church Subgenius. As a matter of fact, Reverend Stang tried to sue Nelson, but Canadian law didn't apply to the American situation. So I wasn't part of that, but that's how the meme of me being connected to J.R. Bob Dobbs of the Church Subgenius started in the early 90s. And then I went to Los Angeles and was on the radio down there for a couple of years, and then I went to New York and was on the radio. And more people became aware of me, but I always pointed to my book, Vatic Communion with Bob Dobbs, as the artifact that I should be identified with, and any tapes of the Canadian CKLN show. So you have Nelson Thal's creation of me, which is just tapes of my show mixing with music, and then you have the Church Subgenius, and they got mixed up. The only area that we coincide with the Church of Subgenius is the fact that my father was a photograph I showed Reverend Stang in February 1978 was the one that inspired their image of J.R. Bob Dobbs.
Well, I'm glad we got that misconception cleared up, Bob, because, you know, when I go onto the website, into the internet, as you know, there's a lot of confusion with the J.R. Dobbs or the picture of the pipe and everything else. So I'm kind of glad we got that cleared up with the listeners. So no affiliation at all with the Church of the Subgenius.
That's right, but and nothing to do with their artifacts or what they do, but I will say that I welcome the confusion since their image of J.R. Bob Dobbs approximates the life and slack that I've had for all these years. So I considered Reverend Stang as much as Frank Zappa and a few other people as John the Baptist who prepared the world for me, and they did it through media synchronicity. So the accent and the confusion works on my behalf, so I don't make any money off of their operation, but I welcome the confusion because it gives me a chance to explain who I am.
Now, Bob, you mentioned a lot of, I was reading this Paranoia article, and there's a lot of mention about your association and communication with Marshall McLuhan to what some people consider, now, that he had a closed circuit of friends that he associated with. How did you happen to penetrate that circle of friends and become associated with Marshall McLuhan?
Well, if you go to fivebody.com/project, you'll see my diaries under something called Android Memes and Acrony, and you'll see a lot of diary entries since the 30s there, which gives some of the details of what I'm going to tell you. But basically, in 1953, I had screwed up with my employers, with the government in Iran, and then in 54 with the government in Guatemala, so I was kind of banned from Europe and sent to the boondocks in Nova Scotia, Canada. And but at the same time, fortunately, McLuhan started his journal called Explorations. The first issue was December 1953. And my employers were shocked at how close he was in describing the attitude of the Secret Council 10 and what they did in what's called tetrad management. Tetrad is a term that McLuhan developed many years later, but the process he basically intuited in the early 50s was too close for comfort. So I was instructed through my father and the Secret Council 10 to go meet this obscure English professor in 1954 and figure out how he came across this knowledge, which was proprietary. So I introduced myself to McLuhan in the spring of 54 and eventually got to find out where he got it from, and it was from a man named Wyndham Lewis, who was a man born in 1882 in just off in the Bay of Fundy, just off Amherst, Nova Scotia, an American father and a British mother, but his parents split, so he ended up growing up in London area and went to school and became a famous artist. He then became the inspiration for T.S. Eliot, James Joyce, Ezra Pound in a movement called Vorticists in 1914-1915. He then became a very controversial writer and painter in the 20s, and he was kind of ostracized, but he understood the dynamics of what we'll call the Fondi apparatus in London, which was the head of the empire at that point. And he met Marshall McLuhan during World War II when he was stationed in Toronto, because he was a Canadian by birth, so he kind of in World War One had fought for Canada as well as Britain and painted for the Canadian government. But he didn't want to fight in the Second World War, so he's over in Toronto. So he meets McLuhan, and McLuhan learned a lot from his encounters with Wyndham Lewis, which took place in Toronto and down in St. Louis, Missouri, where McLuhan was teaching at the time till 44. So they became very good friends. So I found out that Wyndham Lewis was the reason McLuhan got an edge on every other English professor or thinker. And Wyndham Lewis, as you see in the diary entries on fivebody.com/project, was a friend of my father's. And I actually met Wyndham Lewis when I was in my teens. And so the interesting thing is that was the first time I had the experience of xenochrony, which is strange synchronicity, where things in my life would be encountered and answered through events in the media and people strongly involved in the media of that time. So that's why McLuhan got a step up on everybody. And then I became an acquaintance, hung out with him at his office in the late 50s. And then I decided in the early 60s to create a more global audience for him. So I went to New York City and arranged for a magazine that was publishing Tom Wolfe to get Tom Wolfe to interview him. And then we got Howard Gossage in there, the ad man out in San Francisco. So I'm largely responsible for McLuhan becoming a global name.
Well, from this article I'm reading, Bob, it said you spent the rest of the 1950s become very interested in American pop culture, especially you worked with Frank Zappa, or you were listening to Frank Zappa, and it was Frank Zappa was sort of an inspiration with some of your thoughts?
Yes, what happened is that growing up in this cloistered aristocratic environment in France in the 20s and 30s, I had no contact. I didn't have a regular education. I knew Paris life, jazz and that, whatever, but I didn't know much about what was going on, never experienced anything in America. So when I came here in late 53 and 54, through my friend Marcel Duchamp, I had access to a lot of interesting things in New York City, but I started listening to the radio, and I just loved doo-wop, which your opening song is very appropriate. That comes out of the doo-wop R&B tradition. You're John Mayer, is it?
Yes, John Mayer.
Yeah. And I love that kind of music for some reason. And so then I was driving around the States, and I was out in Mojave Desert near Lancaster, where Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart were in high school in 58, I think it was. And I was out there doing research into UFOs because Roswell had happened and all kinds of things. So my employers were interested in what the heck was this phenomenon. And I was in a nightclub one night, and I heard these two teenagers talking. This is, I think it was a Bo Diddley concert, some club around the Lancaster area, small, dinky, you know, in the desert. Mm-hmm. Kind of club, and I heard one of them say Fast and Bulbous, and the other said Tight and Tapered, which, if you remember, was a phrase later showed up in Trope Mass Replica, Beefheart's album produced by Zappa, came out in 68-69. But I was curious, and I mean, I had no qualms with just talking to anybody, because essentially being a spy, you're quite social. You need any information you get. So I started talking to these two kids. And eventually, whenever I went back to Lancaster, I'd look him up, and then he started the studio in Cucamonga. That's Frank Zappa, he and Don. And I was there at those sessions and became a friend. And then I helped promote him in 66 when the album came out. See, I did a lot of things. I knew people, key positions in journalism and that, so I was able to get these reporters. I got Tom Wilson interested in seeing Frank Zappa. Now, I ended up doing this with about eight people, and I created a little army, which was my own operation, that I was creating the media to counter my employers with the advice of my father, who knew the Secret Council 10 was going down and going to be weakened in power as this strange new world was unfolding. So through Zappa, I learned a lot more about American rock and its history and rock and roll and jazz and everything else, so I had the best teachers. McLuhan and Zappa were my teachers as well as my agents. And that was all part of getting acquainted with North America. Am I going on too long?
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
No.
So I knew Frank, and when I was with Bob Dylan, when he was recording John Wesley Harding, I was telling him about Frank Zappa, and Bob Dylan made that the theme of his story on the back, you know, the liner notes part of the cover of John Wesley Harding, where he talks about Frank Zappa. And if you know how to read it, it's all about Frank's show he was putting on at the Garrick Theater in the spring, summer of 1967 in the Village, called Pigs Absolutely Free, Pigs and Repugnant.
Now,
it's a critique by Dylan of Zappa.
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of this music, when you look into the liners and everything, there are, you know, that's the one good thing about going back, just off subject a little, but going back into the vinyl era, there's a lot of things that in those days with Bob Dylan and Frank Zappa, that they wrote a lot of interesting lyrics, and you go into the back of the album jackets on the vinyl, you see a lot of important information that, you know, you miss on a lot of CDs today.
I agree. That makes LPs very important if you're really serious about understanding the artist you're interested in.
Now, it's funny you mentioned McLuhan and E.T.'s there, because there was a quote by McLuhan that says, "There are no passengers on spaceship Earth. We are all the crew."
Yeah.
Now, what was McLuhan's take on UFOs and extraterrestrial beings? Or did you agree with it at the time? Or do you agree with it now?
Well, it's not a matter of agreement with McLuhan, because he didn't really have a point of view, and that's what we spies have, is not a point of view. We don't... We don't identify with the cultures we're infiltrating, but let's go back to what he said about UFOs. And these are probes by McLuhan, what he called probes. He has, if you look at his book, War and Peace in the Global Village, came out in 1968, he has a picture of a computer face, how you would look at a computer as they were made, you know, mainframe computers in that period. And he has little dots, and you're supposedly looking at the screen of the computer, and it says, "Can you read this interplanetary message?" That's how McLuhan interpreted computers. You then read in another part of the book where he says anti-gravity vehicles are natural once you're in an electronic environment, which makes a floating condition where space and time are canceled, what he called the discarnate state, an extension of your central nervous system. So you're in this strange new environment, and the fact it's not limited to visual space's gravity dynamic, then the idea of anti-gravity vehicles are evoked by the electronic environment. That was another point he said. I know that he was on CBC with his son Eric around that time, and he talked about the making of pyramids, and he said they probably could levitate them because they understand acoustic space, or they understood acoustic space at the time, which was tribal sensibilities that were not limited by the effect of writing. So he had that comment, and then he said another time in his letters, I think it is, that he wouldn't be surprised that some corporations have developed anti-gravity vehicles since the 20s. So we have all these different views of it, but he's basically saying that anti-gravity or extraterrestrial operations... Ah, here's the other thought. He said about the famous invasion by Mars by Orson Welles, that radio show about 1938. You remember when Orson Welles did that?
Yeah, War of the Worlds, yes.
War of the Worlds. And McLuhan commented on that in the early 70s, and he says, basically, Orson Welles was miming the invasion from Mars, which was the actual sort of anthropomorphic interpretation of the invasion caused by radio. So what does McLuhan mean by that? He meant that the devastating effects of radio and television for literate cultures or even primitive cultures and semi-industrial cultures was way more powerful and disruptive than if any UFOs showed up. And the reason is that when everybody's listening to the radio, and, you know, there were just a few stations back then, everybody's in the discarnate state. Everybody's in the same space, the same electronic membrane. Whereas if you were on a UFO, you'd be able to be, like McLuhan would say, be like an angel and go wherever you wanted to go. But wherever you went, that's the only space you'd be in. Whereas when you watch live TV, radio, listen to radio, everybody is in that unbounded space. So he called that super angelic. So UFOs were only angelic, as opposed to the electronic environment, which humans created, is super angelic. So just having that effect in the 20th century, you can see why UFOs, if let's assume they aren't real, there's no life out there. I personally think there is, but let's just say, for those who are skeptical, there's no life out there, it would be natural for people to start hallucinating images of UFOs, because that would be like translating the space of an automobile into the floating condition of the discarnate effect of electric media. So the actual pop culture phenomenon of UFOs and being abducted is a folkloric version of being abducted by the electronic environment. And focusing into the angelic image of one vehicle. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's very interesting because I come across another quote of Marshall McLuhan here, how we're infiltrated with television and radio and right now the Internet. It says, television has brought the brutality of war into the comfort of the living room. Vietnam was lost in the living rooms of America, not on the battlefields of Vietnam. So it just shows to show that television has a big effect on people nowadays, and especially the Internet, Bob. You know, there are a lot of disinformation, as you know, on the Internet, and people aren't really reading anymore. You know, they're just looking up all their information on the Internet and watching these mindless soaps and serials on TV. What is your opinion of this whole mass media influx now?
I think it's great. I think it prevents us from having nuclear war. There were plans in the 50s and 60s to have some limited nuclear wars, but the acceleration caused by instantaneous communication prevented the world government, which was a subset of the Secret Council on 10, the solar government, from implementing their paranoid Big Brother plans. And you get to the point where now it's so accelerated, no authority in any medium, including the news media, can control in a Pavlovian sense, stimulus and response, the huge hallucinating effect of people responding to this accelerating interaction. And that has been the accidental service of this devastating new media, new electronic and digital media. It is devastating for the literate historical background medium. It's devastating to pre-literate cultures, to every culture. No culture can stand the impact of this new superangelic state. But if we learn to understand the effects of these media, then we wouldn't be addicted to the point where we're losing our literacy. Because what is the point of reading something for a long time if you need to know what's forming the market or whatever you want to do to make the livelihood? And if you can do it fast through cell phones and internet and whatever you got, then you're functioning in the present.
Right.
But we have so much naturally in stock in our, what I call memes, our habitual memes of our past media, that we have a great nostalgia for literacy. And a great nostalgia for that slower pace of life.
Mm-hmm.
So the way you look at this without a point of view, what McLuhan called the technique of suspended judgment, you understand why the literate and the book medium is anemic, why it doesn't hold kids or anybody's attention, and it's going to melt away even more. But you understand the disservices of the new situation as well as the services. So it's not a simple opinionated response one gives once you move into this attitude of being a tetrad manager who studies the effects of the communication environments. So I have no problem reading. I got all the time I want to read if I want to, because I know that everything talked about in the content of the digital media is process. It never has a finish line. Nothing will be decided. And the managers of the TV environment or the older electronic analog media, like, you know, the Today Show or Larry King, they will feed off the confusion caused by the digital and provide a stability which is not practical for what's happening, but many people live in that zone, and that's the popularity of Fox TV in the United States. It gives an image of the past for the TV body.
Well, Bob, with all these people gathering information on us, such as Project Echelon, which stores a lot of data on everybody around the world, McLuhan says the more the data banks record about each of us, the less we exist. Now, you know, everybody's...
Now, let me just tell you, James, he then followed up. He said, because the data banks know so much about us, way more than we know,
right. There
was a nostalgia starting in the 70s for forgetfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So when people go around going, whatever, and they don't seem to focus on anything,
right. That's
an effect of it's a counter-natural human stubborn response to counter the super omniscience of the databases. And so we're not really getting dumber and dumber. We're just getting indifferent to the fact they know something about us. So we go stupid as an anti-environment to it. And we don't want to remember anything. And that's a good move. You don't need to remember anything. Everything's remembered for you. So the other antidote is to create many identities for yourself. Okay, go ahead.
Well, Bob, you know, a lot of the young people now, you know, as you talk to young people...
There's no such thing as young people.
Well,
we're all one membrane. You're thinking of the chemical body. And the chemical body is only one of our four bodies. Most kids are living in a digital space, super angelic, and they're ageless. Because what they experienced within 7 years of their life is way more than anybody in the previous century ever... had if they were Merlin the Magician, even.
Yeah, but
okay. Back to what you were saying.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is the young people's, what I call young people's ability to question authority, to question what's going on. It seems to be lacking from the days that you and me grow up. You know, they seem to take everything for granted. They don't seem to question certain things, and to me, that doesn't seem the way to go through life.
Okay, they don't understand why they're that way. But if you take my knowledge and view, you can look at why they don't need to rebel against authority. Authority of what? Old industrial establishments, old religions. Their main point is to stay in tune with the present, so they look robotic.
Right.
And they also understand that there's no point of view, that nothing ends, and they therefore just engage in what McLuhan called the participation mystique. They're just totally involved. And so they're not going to rebel, but they are very independent in their personal way they conduct themselves privately, many secret lives. That's why they like conspiracy stuff. They
mm-hmm.
they like the idea there's a private space, but they're talking about their chemical body having a private space. But digitally, there's nothing to rebel against. There's just perceptual overload and perceptual swimming in whatever data you want. Why would you have a point of view? There's nothing to rebel against. That's another reason why the Secret Council tends, as one of the old economic authorities, you know, melted away. There's no ground for it. So now, how do you wake these kids, in quotes, up to the history of the world? That's another problem. McLuhan said turn off television, at least
yes. For
6 months, give people media fast. We can't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a real difficult problem here. The great theosophist Madame Blavatsky said that by the end of the 20th century, you'd have kids being a sub-race. And for older people, they look like sub-humans. But we need to approach the problem in a more sophisticated way that's not involved with political agenda, economic agendas, whatever, because we've all gone super cyborg in a matrix. That's the fact. Now, how do you communicate, which is what I do, and that's why I say I'm the only man alive. I understand the communication problems today. I understand how to break through them, but nobody understands me, mm-hmm. So I'm on another level, the only man alive. Well, so I don't think your image is what mm-hmm. people, what the boomers rebelled against in the 60s
yes.
was newspaper issues, mm-hmm. chemical body, war and death and starvation issues. Those things have not been solved, but the later Generation X and Generation Y, they're swimming in new super angelic environments, and they can't even remember any of those authorities or rebel against. They rebel against whatever, their friends. Mm-hmm. They argue and become lifestyle demographics, so a lot of them drop out and become born again, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't in their life. If they're born again, they still got to make money in the digital environment. They still got to survive, so they go work at Walmart.
Well, you know, you mentioned the solar government a little while ago, Bob. Now, on the show, we mentioned a lot about the New World Order and actually our central government taking over the establishment of this form government now. Now, can you explain to the listeners what exactly you mean by the solar government?
Okay, let's see. What people think of as conspiracy, and they usually call the bankers, the bankers' conspiracy. Well, where did the bankers come from? They came from the printing press 400 years ago. The Bank of England was formed in 1694. Now, you had almost 200 years of the printing press, and you had the formation of nations. You had the rise of the Protestant nations, Germany and England, and the Vatican was a little weak at that point. But the Vatican was the intelligence agency before the printing press. They ran the Western Empire to the degree they had to run it. Just by having the manuscript culture, they could control people's minds back then. The people didn't even get to read. It was just the mystique mm-hmm. of this hidden manuscript text up on the podium, up on the altar. Okay, so the printing press fragments that. Then you have bankers as an institution able to coordinate currencies between nations from a central position. So that could be considered a conspiratorial, a charmed circle of control. Then you bring in the newspaper and the telegraph. That fragments the control of banking. And so you have one of your first crashes in 1907. But when you bring in radio, the super angelic effect of radio crashed the control of the printing presses and the banking, so the economy collapsed. And what happened at that point was that the private ownership of the central bank's printing press money was handed over to the governments because paper money and the printing press became a given environment, and so citizens were allowed through socialism, fascism, the New Deal, right. different setups of basically acknowledging that everybody has the right to some basic paper money to survive. They were moving off the agricultural level of control. So then you move into World War II and into the digital world starting in the 50s and the credit card. Money, and you move into Keynesian's economics. Keynes' economics was that you can go into unemployment. We don't have to be always in debt and keep right. our debts canceled. When money becomes public property, that's not as much of a problem. So money became something shared, and the public owned money. And so the bankers sat on the sidelines managing this old environment to the degree it was a media landscape. But it had to deal with the new landscapes, and therefore you had inflation, stagflation in the 70s. Now, when you get into the digital era and information is currency, not paper money, where is the control? Mm-hmm. McLuhan said super audiences were like super enterprises, were like super audiences working for themselves. This is the participation mystique. Now, what happened in the late 70s is that the banking authorities around the Rockefellers or the American Empire, because they had given out so much money in terms of loans, foreign aid and all that, which was like spreading the ownership of money around the world, that collapsed due to the digital speed up. And so you had those high interest rates brought in by Volcker in the late 70s, early 80s, Paul Volcker. And there was only one group left with gold and paper money that was not based and distributed by loans. These people, the Secret Council 10 people, were sitting on the sidelines, and they're the only ones that had any gold and credit. prop up that media image of money, the after image I call it, in relation to a world run on information and the news. So the Rockefellers were bankrupt. That control of money was gone. So then you had junk bonds. They collapsed in the early 90s, and mm-hmm. then you had the digital dot-com boom, and money that gave itself away mm-hmm. just to adapt to what I call the Android meme. So I'm giving you a history of the phases of money. Now, when the radio environment came in, you had the League of Nations, which was an attempt by the Fondi through the 20s, before money disappears and becomes public property, disappears for the private ownership of money. So you have an attempt of a world government, right? Okay?
Yes.
Then comes in the United Nations. But because the United Nations was inside of a bigger information environment than the radio era of the League of Nations, it never really got off the ground other than a PR. Because the real control for the money system moved to the solar government, which is not something on Mars or the moon, but what the satellite telecommunications environment that started to be built in the early 60s, which is known now as Echelon, mm-hmm. the control of what new technologies are coming in, what management of memes is allowed to happen, that's information control. The Secret Council 10 didn't have to do much, but they sat there in case it got out of control. And so that's the solar government, as opposed to the world government. The world government is just a bunch of bickering bureaucrats in the United Nations. It's an obsolete medium. It's tiny. It's a product of radio and TV and nothing to do with the dynamics of power in the present super angelic world where everybody participates and at the same time the chemical body starves.
But don't...
for nutrition, for social community, for any of the traditional humanist situations that people have been used to for 300 years. It's all gone. We're isolated in our little pods in the matrix.
Mm-hmm.
So does that give you a clue of what the solar government is?
Yes, I agree with you on a lot of spots there, Bob, but don't you think that there is some sort of, especially in the U.S., like some sort of a world government actually taking place and forming events right now?
No, you have to, okay. By 1990... you had the digital environment expanding, and I say that just as they turned money into public property in the 30s, mm-hmm. the digital environment was democratized in the 90s through the dot-com, so everybody could have super access to information, that's graphic and verbal and visual information, actual obsolete information since it's too static,
mm-hmm.
whereas in a world of process, you don't even need to know anything to govern.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this Android meme became public property in the 90s. But what was secretly happening is that the Secret Council 10 and its leftovers, including new people coming up from the world government structure, which was just the old corporations in the United Nations, they were confronting this post-information situation, this post-digital democracy, and they threatened that it's all going to collapse with Y2K.
Yes.
Of course, nothing happened because the digital environment had really actually stopped as a constitutive force by 1990, and the 90s themselves, the democratization and sharing of the digital technology for the masses, was just an afterimage. What was creeping up was we were moving into what I call a neo-paleolithic post-information society. And, of course, the White House is the central meme generator for the TV landscape, or mm-hmm. the TV body, as I call it. And it always resonates with the mood and technology and the media environment of each decade. And we could go through from Eisenhower on up. But who is the image that resonates for this decade in what I call a post-information society? It's a person or an image that does not read the newspapers, cannot communicate verbally in any skillful way, is indifferent to that communication effort, and yet remains charismatic, at least in his first term, as a result of the ground, which is a post-information mm-hmm. society. That is President Bush, mm-hmm. his image at least.
Mm-hmm. On that-
now we've come to an interesting point. We're at this crisis where there is no security, no meaning to the non-communicating image. So So we're right now at the most terrifying point for many people.
That's right.
And they call it the, tomorrow they're scheduled to be an invasion of Iran.
Yes.
A bombing
6th.
Of Iran, April 6th.
Mm-hmm, April 6th.
And all through the second term of the Bush administration, people have thought apocalyptic things are going to happen, the end of the world, Third World War III. But that's all an expression of the paranoia that comes where there's nothing to secure you, even in your little matrix womb. So, your question was, who is controlling us now? Katie Couric is stronger than Henry Kissinger, and that's for the older people. For the young kids, there's nobody controlling them.
No.
They're not even here. They're in their chip body. And so they, in their private lives, they might scarf down junk food and take drugs and all that. They're going to have pretty damaged chemical bodies in 15 years. But they only see the chemical body as one quarter of themselves. So you really have to be careful on talking about control. The United Nations is the afterimage of the world government, and what's that doing? It can't even get any money going.
That's
it can't
right.
implement itself. So the merger of hijackers of the solar government, what I call a ghetto situation, with the White House image is what is being monitored now. And as you see, I mean, they talk about the Bush administration having all the scandals, but every administration in the last 34 years has scandals. The turnover of anybody who thinks they're running the show out of the White House doesn't last very long.
No, it doesn't.
Their stay in power doesn't last because there is no power there. The power is in a nebulous place of communication, and I claim that I'm that power. Now, how I control this situation is really postgraduate work to understand. And I'm talking as an egomaniac. It's just if you understand what's going on, the Android meme mirrors you. So there's all these movies about me all the time.
Right.
I just went to a movie last night. I recommend it called The Last Mimsy. Have you heard of it?
Yes.
Did you see it?
Not yet.
Anyways, there's me right in there, what I'm doing this week. How does it happen that what I'm doing this week and then I go see the movie? That kind of what I call xenocrony goes on all the time with me. As a matter of fact, I just saw Borat the other day.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Right.
Now I'm getting ready to go on a trip. Mm-hmm. And the Borat movie totally resonated with where I've got to go.
It's like a deja vu kind of thing.
Yeah, it's well, a deja vu before it's happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, Bob, we're going to take a short break and we're going to come right back.
The Vatican's view of Christ's theology and LaRouche's view. And the Vatican is for population expansion, against contraception and birth control, and the birth control pill in particular. And Pope Paul VI's encyclical in the 60s or 70s, whenever he wrote it, he died in 1978, LaRouche used to quote. Now, probably people would say, well, the Vatican wasn't into population explosion or population expansion for the technical reasons LaRouche was, because he said it was necessary to increase population density to continue technological progress. Most people would say, critics of the Vatican would say, oh, they're just trying to limit people to barefoot and pregnant, as Skolnick would say. And to keep them occupied with having babies, you know, anti-feminism, anti-individual autonomy, and all that stuff. That may be true. And if it's true, then LaRouche was creating a new kind of Catholic theology to fit technological liberalism.
Yeah, he probably, I mean, I don't know my history that well, but it sounds like he's one of the first people to come along and try to integrate Christianity and science after this polar split between Christianity and science for the last 2,000 years.
Yeah, no, that's what was original to him. There may have been some other writers who tried that, but he was the most...
Hi, we're back with my guest Bob Dobbs on Cosmic Horizons. Now, Bob, in the last segment there on that short break, we heard a passage from the Fatic Communion. And it deals, what I can gather, with religion, views, and perspectives. Now, in your opinion, Bob, is religion ruling the world with the so-called prophets as doomsday sayers?
Is religion ruling the world?
Yes.
Manuscript, that's religion is manuscript culture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the manuscript medium resonates with the collage mosaic life that people experience in their modern media diet. The manuscript is a resonating form compared to the prose of smooth printed book. It's multi-leveled. And so the images of, we're talking about media memes. So the manuscript is not moldless anymore like it did before the printing press. But there's a nostalgia for the images and sensibility for that, and people call that religion. Okay, so then you got these cultures that around the world are not accepting the industrial dynamic of Western capitalism, including in the United States. You got many citizens angry at the Washington or at the bankers,
yes.
And they go fundamentalist with the Christian manuscript meme.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the battle of these memes of the manuscript culture. They certainly have no impact on our lives today. The only prophet of our time was James Joyce with his book Finnegan's Wake, and not just because of whatever he believed, but because of the way he wrote the Finnegan's Wake. That book is unreadable unless you train your sensibilities, and McLuhan spent his life translating and helping people understand Finnegan's Wake. But that's the last book. There's no book that is relevant to our situation and no manuscript meme. What is powerful, what is religious, is American Idol. In the sense that religion is something that people focus on and put a lot of emotional energy in. All right? Now, a lot of people aren't watching Idol. They're watching sports, or they're watching, they're driving their cars. Media themselves, technology themselves, is the religious impulse conduit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people say, well, there's more than this life. Yeah, there's more than this life, perhaps, and there's all kinds of reference points in culture and history. A lot of people like the shaman world. They like psychedelics or modern retrievals of the shamanistic rituals.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is finding some kind of cultural reference point, which is just a meme, to adapt to the present. And the present is the most religious spiritual condition we live in. No culture has ever been as unified as we are and has allowed such democratic diversity of human communication expression. So I say we're in the second coming if we're going to hoik up the Christian meme. Whatever other cultures say it is, I say that's been realized, whatever they're prophesying. We are beyond time and space. We have gone past any apocalyptic situation, and we're having a surf. I mean, we're surfing right now. It's SpongeBob. That's what it is.
But you said we're past any apocalyptic doomsday.
Traditional manuscript or older media expressions of apocalypse, which means super revelation. We have super revelation for our quark cells. We're not even chemical bodies anymore. So the revelation of that is whatever you turn into and respond to on your computer or your radio or your Walkman, whatever media you're into, or the basketball you bounce.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, we are in an unprecedented gobbledygook of revelation every day, 24/7, and no wonder for the chemical brain, it is literally diagnosed as insane. And if people came from 100 years ago and walked around in Toronto or New York City or anywhere, they'd think that people were like hijacked and taken over by some strange alien force.
Right.
Now, how do you teach kids, if there are such things anymore, to adapt to the present and preserve some sense of what previous media meant? It's an impossible situation. So the worst janitors of our time are the educational establishment.
So you just said the educational establishment is not, you don't prefer it, or you don't think that they're teaching what they're supposed to teach? Or?
They're the janitors. They're the ones that have a hopeless situation of trying to keep up the garbage apocalypse and put order in it, and they can't do it. It's impossible. And the hypocrisy of the education establishment is that they claim they are doing something. But paradoxically, no one else is taking care of the chemical kids, so at least they give a place for the kids to hang out. The kids certainly aren't living in the dynamism, the anemic dynamism of the educational environment. And then even the term educational establishment is ridiculous. I mean, the establishment is... was Barbara Frum in your country, and I don't know what it is now, whatever News World offers or whatever your TV shows are, but here it's Katie Couric and 60 Minutes or American Idol.
Right.
That's the educational establishment. And then there's the fact that the form of the media is the bigger change, and that's why, say, television, or McLuhan would say, that television had a bigger effect and on all cultures than any UFO contact were going to happen. Because the UFO contact that does happen, and I'll tell you how it's going to happen, it's going to come from the Bootes constellation, and they're going to put a device on a space station circling the Earth, and the device will say, press here, and the astronaut or whoever's occupying the space station will press it, and at that point, there'll be a beginning of communication with the civilization from the Boodians constellation. Seven stars, one of them is Arcturus. The collective constellation is called Boodies, B-O-O-T-E-S, with an umlaut over one of the O's. That is what's going to happen. But they are going to interact with this amazing communication situation that we'll be in the mid-2020s when it'll happen, and you'll see that they will have to be marginalized just like the central bankers were in the 20th century. Now, they will change a lot of reference points for people, and they will have lots of things to inspire us for creating interstanding gravity vehicles, but since we're already in the super angelic state, they're going to be as fascinated by what we've turned into as we will by them. So anybody who claims they're abducted and then say that these guys are going to come save us, you know, that's bull.
Well, I got one last question where a famous McLuhan quote where it says, a famous quote by Marshall McLuhan, is the medium is the message. Now, how true is that saying in today's world, Bob?
What's it mean to say true? What does true mean to you?
Well,
true. Which medium of truth? What truth medium? Anyways, you know, Pontius Pilate says to Jesus, what is truth?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the truth back then was based on the phonetic alphabet, on the manuscript. What is the truth today? The truth is what the White House says. If the UFOs land and abduct everybody in the U.S., and then there's 10 people left and we're looking at President Bush, and he denies it happened, that's the facts. And you're stuck with it. So it's called, the theme is called The Word Makes the Market. So what is truth? I think the truth is to take the environment and look at the medium that you're using, just like what we're using now, satellite internet radio, and look at its effects on previous media and what it does to our present concepts of things, and say the effects of that approximates reality or the facts, and that's the truth. If you mean by truth a factual situation or an inspirational situation, we're inspired by being in this space right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun, okay? That's why everybody wants to be on American Idol.
That's
it's
right.
It's a fun experience, what's it like to be discarnate in an active sense. But back to the medium as a message, so I'd say that's the truest formula we could ever come up with at this point, and it's actually going to apply in 500 years when we're going to have the final Armageddon. And in that Armageddon, we're going to have invented a device, and we're going to be smart enough to realize its effects, and we're going to realize the effects are that we're going to, if we press this button and implement this as a new environment, a new communication medium, we'll forget everything we ever were, which is like an image of death in a way. And we're going to have a big battle whether to press that button or not. But at the time, everybody's going to go, yep, the medium is the message. We see the effects. What do we do? Do we accept the effects or not? So, there's no better statement than the medium is the message. But I wouldn't, it took McLuhan 22 books to explain it.
Now, I got one closing comment to add, Bob. Now, what do you think about people's perception of the media these days, the people that you talk to? Considering internet and television are playing a role in shaping people's lives, what's Bob Dobbs' opinion and perception of the media today?
Well, first of all, I say there are no media. When McLuhan wrote, there was television, and there was radio, and books, and newspapers, and bulldozers, and skyscrapers. These were separate artifacts. Under Android meme conditions, we're in a seamless web. In the digital situation, a kid has all kinds of means of communication, and it contains this huge former media environments, movies, TV, radio, and all that content. Now it's a seamless web, so they don't have the media environment as McLuhan defined it. So I say that we live in a condition of the cloning of ESP. We're so intimately vibing any approximation of an image of the second coming that let's use ESP. We have cloned ESP with our electronic and digital environment, and then, especially with the digital, allow people to disconnect from the ESP. Like in the Zardos movie where the one guy rebels and says, I'm not going to be part of this. You know, the Sean Connery movie was Zardos. So that rebellious, that ability to disconnect from the cloned ESP and create a situation of voluntary engagement with it, or voluntary ESP, is the right way to define our time. So the medium is the message is a truism, but the actual perception of our time is represented by me and allows me to be the only man alive, is to understand what it means to relate cloned ESP with voluntary ESP. And to then understand that when cold fusion comes in and moves us into a new kind of hardware energy where more energy comes out than goes in, what is a frictionless-based society, that will solve the tyranny that we're in right now to the degree that you think there is tyranny, and all that tyranny is only memes of previous media. You worry about the central bankers, you're working in the newspaper medium and its afterimage. You're worrying about media propaganda and news censorship, then you're in the TV body.
Right.
If you're in the digital body, you don't care. You end up like a kid in Japan today who refused to come out of their bedroom. They sit in their bedroom for 2 years, hanging out in their chip body. And then they might commit suicide at some point, or they might not. But there's suicide rampant all over the culture.
Now, Bob,
is that negative? Is that negative?
No, to me that's positive.
What, that everybody's killing themselves?
No, no, not that. I think there's a lot of positive things in media today. And
now, there's no media. You got to use the news. Just say Android meme.
Android
meme. A lot of positive things in the Android meme. Don't use the word media. Now, you might need to do that with your guests because, as T.S. Eliot says, I got to use words when I talk to you. You've got to use old categories. But you'll find the young kids don't respond to those categories in instinct. They might be forced to use them when their parents talk to them. But you got to upgrade your language. That's my message.
Mm-hmm.
Use new terms and be able to explain them. And the point you're making is that we don't need words to discuss anything anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, we're just about out of time. It's been a very interesting and compelling show. Can you tell the listeners out there how to check you out on your website and what your website is to get more information?
Just go to fivebodied.com, FiveBodied. Fivebodied.com, and everything's there.
Well, thanks a lot, Bob. We hope to get you on a future show when you have some time, and I'd like to continue this discussion about a more in-depth interview.
Well, you've responded very well, James. I hope to do it again.
Well, thanks very much. Just hang on the line, Bob, and I'll talk to you off the mic.